Hello and welcome back. I am on page 13 of the book, and the title of the page is Origin of Cells. First box, cell division and cell origins. Well, first of all, you have to understand that in the 19th century, people didn't really know whether cells can only come from pre-existing cells or whether cells can suddenly appear out of non-living material. And this idea that non-living material, like a soup that you've just boiled, okay, that the soup is able to all of a sudden create life, bacteria, that is concept is called spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation is the idea that living things can appear out of non-living material. And that is not correct, okay? But in the 19th century, people thought that this could be the case, okay? So there is no evidence that spontaneous generation exists because it was due to the credit of Louis Pasteur, and it's now the next box towards the right. He was able to show that life can only come from pre-existing life, okay? And what he did is the following. He had this famous swan neck experiment. And basically it's the following. I'm going to jump directly to the two pictures down here. You see a flask, and the left flask contains a very long S-shaped swan neck. It's like the neck of a swan. And what he did is the following. In the glass flask, there is some kind of a nutrient medium, some kind of a soup, okay? And he was boiling that to kill off all the bacteria. And then he basically waited. And you know what happened? Nothing, okay? The soup stayed fine, stayed clear, there were no bacteria, no life formed, okay? And the reason is because due to its long swan neck, no dust and bacteria could actually fall into the soup, okay? Because it got caught in at the bottom of the swan neck, okay? So there was actually no food. The food for the bacteria could not reach the food, in other words, okay? And then he removed the swan neck, and that's now the picture on the right. And then bacteria could fall into the nutrient medium, the nutrient broth, and fungi, fungal spores fell into it as well, and so on. And it got spoiled very quickly. And then when you analyze it under the microscope, you see a lot of bacteria and fungi and, I don't know, whatever, what else, okay? So, but this kind of showed that it will not form life on its own. Bacteria will not form directly, spontaneously out of the soup, okay? And even nowadays, you use the term pasteurized in honor of Louis Pasteur because, for example, food in a tin can or food or certain juices have been pasteurized, and you can store them even without a refrigerator, and they will not turn bad. But if you open it, then you have to eat it very quickly because then you're exposed to the bacteria and then in the air, and then it might spoil quickly. Okay, but as long as you keep it closed, you can store it almost indefinitely. Okay. So next box, origin of the first cells. Well, of course, if you say that spontaneous generation does not exist, well, this kind of begs the question, what about the first cell? What about the very first cell? Yeah, and indeed, the very first cell on Earth must have emerged out of non-living stuff. Yeah, obviously, okay? That's clear, because now we've got life. Before there was no life, and so the first cell must have formed by spontaneous generation in that sense, okay? But it is like this that we can now ask ourselves, well, how often did life actually start on planet Earth? Are we all kind of related to each other, or could it be that life started several times? Well, first of all, we don't know if life started several times. Maybe it did. But in any case, all of the living things that we have now on Earth, they can be traced back to one cell. Okay, and there is pretty solid evidence for that. So in that sense, all of the living things on the world are related. Okay, so it is not like this that they evolved or they emerged or they appeared separately. But it is like this that all living things have a common ancestor, the first cell. The question is now, how do we know? Well, there's a whole lot of genetic evidence, and specifically also the genetic code in all living things, humans all the way down to bacteria. The genetic code is the same. And this means that the so-called the triplets of bases all in, on the DNA, they code for the same amino acids, even though this wouldn't have been necessary. It's not necessary that this works like this, but it still does. So that is then basically a very strong evidence that if there are also alternative ways, yeah, but nature did not use them, well, then this means that all of the living things must have a common ancestor, okay? So the very first cells must have, of course, appeared from non-living matter. And even if life maybe appeared multiple times, all of those other forms of life must have died out, because currently all living things can be traced back to one cell. Okay. Now let's move on. Page 13, the endosymbiontic theory. This theory tries to explain how eukaryotic cells came into being. At the very beginning, we only had simple prokaryotes, okay, the bacterial type of cells, and without a nucleus. And then later on, we had the more complicated eukaryotic cells with the cell organelles. And how does this actually happen? And what I will do is I will actually explain the diagram on the right. At the very beginning, we had a host cell which contained a nucleus, and then there's an aerobic bacterium. Aerobic means it requires oxygen. Okay, and this aerobic bacterium then moved into the host cell and became a mitochondrion. Okay, so the aerobic bacterium kind of benefited because it now was protected in a larger cell, in the host cell, and the host cell benefited because now the mitochondrion or the aerobic bacterium was able to do cell respiration and to provide a lot of ATP. So both of them benefited, and that's called symbiosis. When two organisms benefit from each other, it's called symbiosis. And endosymbiosis means that within, so basically a symbiosis within a cell, okay, because the bacteria moves into the cell. And this happened a second time, where a photosynthetic bacterium, most likely a cyanobacterium, moved into the cell, and this then became the chloroplast, okay? So from the eukaryote with the aerobic bacterium, this is when the animal cells branched off there, and then later on also the chloroplast was formed by having a photosynthetic bacterium move into the cell, and we have then a chloroplast, okay, and that became then the plant cells. Now you might wonder, okay, anyone can say that. Is there some evidence for that? Yeah, there's quite a bit of evidence like that, okay? First of all, mitochondria and chloroplasts, they divide inside the cell like bacteria. It can be observed, okay? They have their own DNA even, and of course the scientists did DNA studies and they discovered many similarities of mitochondrial DNA with a so-called the proteobacteria. You don't have to know that, okay? But there is a very much genetic similarity, okay? So their DNA, they have a naked loop of DNA, and you know what? They have their own ribosomes even. Chloroplasts and mitochondria have their own ribosomes, and their ribosomes are so-called 70S ribosomes, and these are typical ribosomes of prokaryotes. Because remember, the ribosomes on the RER and in the cytoplasm, these are 80S ribosomes, okay? But the chloroplasts and the mitochondria have their own ribosomes, and they look very much like bacterial 70S ribosomes, okay? And they have double membranes, okay? And the thing is the double membrane is a very strong evidence that the cell has been taken up by endocytosis, okay? So the membrane of the host cell folded around the aerobic bacterium and formed the outer membrane. Okay, and the aerobic bacterium also had its own membrane, and it's a second membrane. Okay, so we have ultimately, the chloroplasts and mitochondria have two membranes, and this is also a strong evidence that one membrane came originally from the bacterium, and the other membrane from the host cell that took it up. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of other evidence as well. Okay, in any case, the endosymbiotic theory I don't know if you can still call it a theory or not. It's already a very, very solid theory in any case. Okay. So we flip the page, and you know what? I will talk about mitosis, cell cycle, and cancer. I'm on page 14, mitosis. Okay. Mitosis is cell division in eukaryotes. mitosis is cell division in eukaryotes, and the thing is the following, that eukaryotes have a lot of DNA and several linear pieces of DNA. And the thing is now the following, it's kind of difficult to move around in a cell. Because when the cell divides, we must make sure that every cell has the same DNA. And if you have now a whole bunch of DNA floating around inside a nucleus, it's very, and you copy that, it's very difficult to make sure that both cells have the same DNA. So what do we do? Or what does the cell do? Well, the cell makes chromosomes out of the loose DNA. Okay, and this is called a condensation. So when the loose DNA is also known as chromatin, when the loose DNA condenses, it forms chromosomes. And condensing means become more dense. Okay, and it does that by a process called supercoiling. Okay, supercoiling, and supercoiling means that it it makes larger and larger loops. Okay. It coils up and then it makes again a coil and it becomes more and more, okay? And don't forget that one eukaryotic cell, one single cell has around 2 meters of DNA, one cell, okay? And now you might wonder, how is this possible that so much DNA can be in a cell? Well, this DNA is extremely thin, okay? But if you want to make sure that both cells have the same DNA after copying, then we have to make sure that we can move around the DNA, and we can only do that in when we have chromosomes. So, another term, next box, chromatids and centromeres, okay? As I already mentioned, the DNA is first copied, and so we have two times the same DNA, and then the DNA condenses to make chromosomes. And these identical pieces of DNA are called sister chromatids, and they're copies of each other, and they will end up later on in two different cells, you know, after cell division. But these sister chromatids are identical DNA, and they're held together at the place on the chromosome called centromere. So the centromere is the place where the two chromatids are held together. Okay? So the DNA is replicated. Replicated means copied. Then the DNA condenses to form chromosomes, and these chromosomes are made of sister chromatids, and the sister chromatids are held together at the centromere. Okay? Now, there is a little bit of a confusion. What is now a chromosome? What is a sister chromatid? Okay. And the IB uses, again, a different system. So it's a little bit confusing sometimes. Sometimes people say when the two chromatids are together, we refer to them as two chromatids held together by a centromere. Okay. And then once they separate the chromatids during mitosis, then people start to call them, well, now we have two chromosomes. I don't know. So is it a chromosome? Yeah, it's a little bit confusing. If they ask you something about that, why don't you just simply sit down and fully explain it, okay? Because sometimes the people will call the two sister chromatids, which are held together, also as one chromosome. There are multiple definitions, but honestly, there is no disagreement concerning the actual biological the biology. There's no disagreement about the biology. The phases of mitosis, okay? I think I'm going to explain you this. Now, this is pretty important. Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. These are the four stages. Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. However, it is important to understand that these phases, one goes into the next one. It's kind of like a fluid transition, okay? And the first thing, we start off with prophase. And I'm simply going to summarize what happens in prophase. In prophase, the DNA condenses to make chromosomes, and the nucleus of the DNA disappears. The nucleus of the DNA disappears. This does not make sense. The nucleus of the cell disappears because the membrane of the nuclear membrane dissolves. Okay, that's basically, so the DNA condenses, the nucleus disappears, and so-called spindle fibers or spindle microtubules start to form. Okay, and these span or stretch through the whole cell. Okay, and what happens is that at the centromere, where the chromatids are held together, this is also where the spindle microtubules attach, and these spindle microtubules will then pull the chromosomes, or the sister chromatids, however you want to call it, to the equator of the cell. And then we are already in metaphase, okay? In metaphase, the chromosomes are now in the middle of the cell. Now, why does it do that? Because we want to establish a form of symmetry here. Okay, we want to establish symmetry. And so number three, the chromosomes are in the middle of the cell now. And in anaphase, what will happen now is the following. The centromere will split and the sister chromatids are separated. Okay, and they are pulled from the equator of the cell to the poles of the cell. Don't forget the two sister chromatids are identical DNA, and one goes into one cell, the other one goes into the other cell, and the same will happen with all the other chromosomes or chromatids in the cell. Human beings have 46, for example, okay? And then, this is anaphase, where the sister chromatids are separated, and then the next one, that's telophase. And in telophase, it's easy to remember, telophase is the reversal of prophase. So the DNA decondenses, the nucleus starts to reappear, the spindle fibers also starts to break down later on, okay? And in late telophase, so far we have not divided the cell yet, we've only separated the DNA, okay? The physical division of the cell is called cytokinesis, and this happens at the very end of telophase after the DNA has already been separated. Yeah? And there are two ways of how cytokinesis can work, because plants and animals do it differently. In the case of animal cells, the cell kind of pinches off. Yeah, it's like it squeezes off in the middle. But in the case of plant cells, you cannot do that because you have a strong cell wall, and this cell wall doesn't want to be pinched. So in plant cells, you have a so-called a cell plate formation. And when we form a cell plate, then we're starting to make a new cell wall and cell membrane in the middle of between the two nuclei. We start to build it from the center, from the middle. Okay, so we don't fold it in from the outside like in a plant, in an animal cell, but we start to build, we're starting to separate the cells from the inside. Okay. So that was it. These were actually the stages of mitosis. I think, again, over here, don't just listen to what I'm saying here. Just watch a YouTube video on the whole thing. Okay, it's so much more and easier to understand if you are actually able to visualize this. Yeah. Last point on this page. I'm just checking the time here. Okay, I've been talking now 16 minutes, 17 minutes. Next point on page 14 is called the mitotic index. The mitotic index is nothing more than the percentage of cells that are doing mitosis. That's the very bottom line. But we don't express it as a percentage, but rather as a decimal. Okay. So the mitotic index is the number of cells in mitosis, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, divided by the total number of cells that you observed. Why is this important? You will find is cells with tissue with high mitotic index and rapidly growing parts of plants, for example, like the tips of the spent stems and the roots are growing very fast, and there are a lot of cells are dividing. And also cancers or tumors, they also have a high mitotic index because they have many dividing cells, and this can also help doctors in doing a diagnosis. Yeah, and then on page 14, the last box over here is called cytokinesis on the right side. Well, I actually already explained this. The implant cells, a new cell wall is formed across the equator, and in animal cells, the plasma membrane folds inward and is pulled inwards, okay? I already explained this, and that is cytokinesis is the division of the cytoplasm, the physical division of the cell, okay? So let's move on. We are now on page 15, and that is the last page. That's the last page of this chapter, Cell Cycles and Cancer. Okay, again, a diagram with which I'm not quite fully happy, but I'll explain you why. What is the cell cycle? It's kind of the life cycle of a cell, okay? So it's the sequence of events that happens between cell division, one mitosis and the next mitosis, okay? So the cell cycle is an alternation between interphase is not part of mitosis. Interphase is the kind of the normal, non-dividing life of a cell. It's called interphase. Inter means between, right? International means between nations. Interphase means between the phase between mitosis. And in interphase, something very important happens. Of course, proteins are made, transcription, translation, and all these things, but also DNA replication. The DNA must be copied during interphase, okay? And the cell cycle that you see over here in the picture kind of shows the in black, the interphase, which is around half, yeah, the top half, and then you have mitosis, which is the bottom half. But in reality, mitosis is much shorter than interphase, much shorter, okay? Here it's like it's 50% of the time. That's not correct. It's, I don't know, much shorter in any case. I don't know, maybe 10% or 20% or 30% maximum. And I'm going to prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase of mitosis I already explained, okay? At the very end of telophase, we have cytokinesis. Also, that is labeled in the cell cycle. And then we're in interphase. And now I need to explain a little bit G1, S phase, and G2. Okay, first of all, what does G1 and the G2 stand for? Not very original. It stands for gap 1 and gap 2. The scientists couldn't really think of a better word here. And the S stands for synthesis. And synthesis means the synthesis of DNA. It's when the time when DNA is copied. Okay, so what happens in G1? Okay, so in G1, the cell is producing proteins. Okay, they will basically make proteins and they will live. But you see, sometimes the cells don't want to divide. So is there a need to make a new DNA if it doesn't want to divide? No. So it's just going to stop in G1 because the cell doesn't feel like dividing. It's not necessary to divide. I can imagine there are certain fat cells, for example, they are there to store fat. There's no real big need for them to divide quickly. Yeah? They're just storage tissue. Yeah. And so some of them will simply stop in G1 because it doesn't have to divide. But some cells have to divide because, I don't know, they're used for repair of tissue or whatever. And then they say, okay, time to go into the S phase to copy the DNA to get ready for cell division. Okay, so it starts copying the DNA in S phase. And then in G2 phase, in gap 2, this is kind of like a checkpoint to check whether all of the DNA has been finished copying. Okay, and if it's a chemical check, and DNA finished copying, okay, so, and the G2, that's kind of like it gives the go signal, and after when we're passing the G2 phase, then there is no return, then we're going into mitosis, and the cell will run through mitosis, okay? So G1S and G2 phase are a part of the cell cycle, okay? So, the next thing, page 15, cyclins and cell cycle control. What are cyclins? Well, that's an example of an accidental discovery. The guy called Tim Hunt, I think was his name, he discovered these cyclins when he was doing research, and he discovered that there are certain proteins, certain substances in a cell that go up and down, and depending on the stage of the cell cycle that they're in. He more or less discovered this by accident. And he got awarded the Nobel Prize, and this accidental discovery of something is called serendipity. Serendipity is the term that we use when scientists discover something even though they did not intend to discover it. It's kind of like an accidental discovery. So now, what do these cyclins do? Well, these cyclins they bind to enzymes, and these enzymes are called cyclin-dependent kinases, and they activate the enzymes. In other words, okay, they switch it on, they turn on the enzymes, and these enzymes then start to attach phosphate groups to other proteins of the cell. Okay, so the cyclins turn on the enzymes, which then attach phosphate groups, and the attaching of these phosphate groups controls now the different events of the cell cycle. Okay, that's kind of the thing that activates the proteins. Okay, so the cyclins activate the different stages of the cell cycle, and you can see in the diagram that if for different stages, different cyclins are there in high concentrations. Okay, I don't think that it's necessary to actually know which cyclin is responsible for what phase. I think the idea is more here like that you understand that there is a very strict and a very detailed control of the cell cycle using chemicals. Okay, so the chemical control here. We move on, page 15, tumor formation. And oncogenesis, the term oncogenesis is the formation of tumors. That's the scientific terms. And there are certain genes, DNA segments, called oncogenes. And these oncogenes control the cell division, the cell cycle. And if there's a problem in these oncogenes, then it can be the cell cycle goes out of control and goes too quickly and runs too fast. And then you have a cell which divides too quickly, and then you have a tumor. Okay. And so in other words, changes to the DNA, mutations, especially to these oncogenes, can disrupt the chemical control of the cell cycle and can cause the cell to divide too quickly. Okay, And now, what are the primary and secondary tumors? That's another term that you have to know. Is if you have a tumor forming on one part of the body, then it's usually a primary tumor. And this means that you have to do something against it. You go to the doctor and you operate it out, and then it's gone. Okay? And then you have removed those cells that divide too quickly. However, if you wait too long, then you have the possibility of so-called secondary tumors, and they are a little more problematic, because what happens is the following, is that some of the cells of this primary tumor will break off. They are going to be carried around your blood transport system, your blood system, circulatory system, to other parts of the body. They will settle down on other parts of the body, and then all of a sudden you have a couple of hundred tumors all over your body. Okay, and that's more difficult to treat then, because how do you want to deal with a few hundred smaller tumors? Yeah, so massive chemotherapy is necessary and all of these things, but you cannot really operate out a couple of hundred tumors. Okay, and the breaking off of the cells from the primary tumor, that's known as metastasis. Okay, metastasis. The cells break off or carried away over the body, over the blood, and they start to settle down somewhere and form new tumors. Okay, that's metastasis. That's something you don't want to wait. Okay, you don't want to wait for. Smoking and cancer. Question is now, does smoking now cause cancer? Yes or no? Well, the thing is the following. Of course, not everyone who smokes will develop cancer. Okay, it's a statistical question. But there is a very high correlation. And as a matter of fact, scientists have now also found a causal relationship. There is actually a chemical in smoke, tobacco smoke, that influences one of these oncogenes. Okay, and there's also this so-called the P53 protein, also not mentioned in the book here, which is important for the cell cycle control. And if tobacco smoke messes up the chemistry of the cell cycle. Okay, and so there is now much more evidence that if you smoke, that this dramatically increases the risk of getting cancer. Okay, and carcinogenic. The term carcinogenic means cancer causing. Okay, so carcinogenic substances cause changes in the DNA of a person. And mutations, in other words, and if some of these oncogenes start to mutate, and then this can be it can mess up the chemistry of the cell cycle, the chemical signaling of the cell cycle, and then the cell can go out of control, and then you have a tumor. Okay, so smoking's pretty bad, as you already know anyway. Okay, yeah, and it's, of course, the more cigarettes smoked per day, the higher the chance of developing cancer. There is a very nice correlation on here. Okay, so this was page 15, and we're finished with topic 1. Okay, and now off to topic 2, but not in this audio file here. Okay, wish you a nice day. Bye-bye.